Okay, I think it's 7:30 and we should get started. Good evening. My name is Elliot Shapiro. I work and teach in Cornell's Knight Institute for Writing in the Disciplines. I also teach several Jewish studies classes on film or several film classes on Jewish studies. Take your pick. We'll talk a little bit more about those classes later. I'm absolutely delighted to be able to welcome Aviva Kempner to Cornell this evening. I am sure I'm not the first person to say at a Cornell Cinema event or some similar event, I really wish we could do this in the Willard Straight Theater. Maybe another time. The silver lining, of course, is that this format allows us to welcome visitors from far and wide. I'm sure there's some people logging in tonight who are not logging in from Ithaca, because I think they told me. Before I introduce our visitor, I'd like to thank Cornell Cinema and Cornell's program in Jewish Studies for making this event happen. In particular, from Jewish Studies, I want to thank Ayla Klein and Deborah Starr. From Cornell Cinema, I particularly want to thank Mary Fessenden and Doug McLaren. Doug, by the way, is in the background right now. You can't see him, but he's making sure the technology works. And if there's a real rush of questions, he'll be helping me with the Q&A. This brings me to a point about format. This is a webinar. You're used to these by now, but you can see us and we can't see you. If you do have questions, you can post them in the Q&A box. You should be able to see that at the bottom of your screen. Excuse me. We will discuss as many as we can. I also admit I have questions of my own. I don't expect to get to all of mine. And I've invited my students to submit questions as well. So if you have questions, this introduction will be over soon. You can start posting them in the Q&A right now. Okay. For the past 4 years, I've been teaching a first-year writing seminar called Jews on Film, Visible and Invisible. This semester, for the first time, I'm teaching a course called Jewish Films and Filmmakers, Hollywood and Beyond. And I suppose since I've been thanking people, I should thank Jewish Studies and the Knight Institute and the Art College of Arts and Sciences for supporting these classes. When I learned that I'd be teaching Jewish films and filmmakers this semester, I immediately started thinking, what was it going to take to bring Aviva Kempner to Cornell? And of course, hoping that that would be like actually bringing her to Cornell and not just on a screen, but you know, again, maybe another time. Kempner's 2009 documentary about Gertrude Berg, titled You Who Mrs. Goldberg, has really played a central role in my Jews on Film class. You Who Mrs. Goldberg, I have the video right here, is a film made by a Jewish filmmaker about a Jewish pioneer of radio and television. It's also a film about a woman who forged an exceptionally long career in radio and TV, two industries that have not always been welcoming to the contributions of women, particularly as the primary creative force behind a series. So I knew that I wanted Kempner's work to be part of this new class as well. Aviva Kempner is the founder and executive director of the Sheshla Foundation. Did I do that right? Okay, excellent. The Sheshla Foundation, and I'm quoting from the mission statement here, produces documentaries that investigate non-stereotypical images of Jews in history and celebrate the untold stories of Jewish heroes. Kempner's films have educated viewers about the lives and achievements of, among others, Baseball Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg. If you like the Mo Berg movie, go watch that. They make a really good pair. Businessman and philanthropist Julius Rosenwald, and Molly Berg, the woman who wrote, produced, and starred in the radio and TV serial The Goldbergs. As you know, Kempner's most recent film, The Spy Behind Home Plate, takes as its subject Mo Berg, professional baseball player, lawyer, and spy. I have lots of questions for Kempner. I'm sure you have questions for Kempner. My students have questions for Kempner. So I should stop talking and we should hear more from our guest. So I said I wanted to start with a question of my own, Aviva. Thank you so much for being here. So I wanted to start by asking you about the mission for the Sheshla Foundation. You also call it your personal mission. How did you decide this was work that needed doing?
Okay. Well, it's interesting. I'm speaking to students today because the example of how I got into filmmaking has to do with switching careers. I actually have an undergrad from Michigan in psychology, which in some ways is the only degree I use, a master's in urban planning, which I use sort of my personal backyard, and Then I went and got a law degree, and I did very well in law school, and I loved it, especially doing human rights work, but I don't do well on multiple choice questions. So it's actually apropos I talk about it today, because my father died 45 years ago today, and it was at the day I was supposed to graduate from law school, and I wound up flunking the bar twice, and I was just looking for something else to do. And I always grew up loving films, and there were certain things that really influenced me growing up and watching different films. And I'm a child of a Holocaust survivor, but my mother didn't talk about it. I learned about the Holocaust through, you know, reading Mila 18, Exodus, reading The Wall, seeing different films. And I just had this notion that I had to go make a film about Jews fighting Nazis, which is the first film I didn't direct, but I produced and co-researched and conceived, called Partisans of Vilna. And then from there, I just kept on saying, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to make films that celebrate unknown Jewish heroes. And from that, it was all American Jewish heroes. And again, it's apropos today to talk a little bit about Hank Greenberg, because I grew up with him in Detroit, with him being my father's hero. He would always talk about him, and there's this whole story that he didn't play on Yom Kippur. We're talking in 34, at the height of domestic anti-Semitism in Detroit. And every time we would go to services for Yom Kippur, there's this very religious service called Kol Nidre. My dad would always talk about Hank Greenberg. I thought he was part of Hank Greenberg. So two things happen with me. I have a great love of baseball, and two, a lot of pride about our heroes. And I guess a lot also being the child of Holocaust survivors. The reason my 501c3 is called Cheshla, it's my mother's name, maiden name, and her parents died in Auschwitz, is really to try to celebrate Jewish accomplishments, since we lost so many people. So, and then from there, it just went on and on. And every film, even Rosenwald, has a touch of it, has to do with World War II. Hmm. Not so much a couple of my current ones, but certainly the big Jewish hero I'm working on now. Mm-hmm. So one would say I'm creatively obsessed. I just made that up, but I think it is.
That's good. That's very good.
It's, you know.
So
it's apropos.
Let me ask, since we're talking about baseball, a question about baseball. You mentioned Hank Greenberg, a hero of your dad, a hero of people in Detroit, a hero of Jews all over America. And it seems like that's very much a movie about fandom. You talked about your own love of baseball. But also, when we talked the other day, you talked about how important baseball was as a way to Americanize immigrants or first generation Americans. I wonder if you'd like to say a little bit more about that, and how that plays a role in your two
business. The forewords, which was written the same way backwards and forwards. It was in Yiddish and English. There's an editor named Abraham Kahan, and it was really sort of the interim newspaper for immigrants first coming to America, especially in New York, and people would ask, you know, write advice to them. And there's a famous letter where one of the parents writes a letter, and they said, oh, what am I going to do? My child likes baseball. What is this? And Kahan answered, he said, this is America. This is, you know, there's a very famous line, if you want to understand America, you got to understand baseball. So I forgot who said it, but it's a classic line. And back then, baseball was, you know, the sport. One could argue it was basketball and football. In any event, so I think for my father, because he came here in the early 30s, it was the way he became American. He came to Pittsburgh. So, sadly enough, it's 45 years ago, my dad died. I started making films 42 years ago. So he never saw any of my films. But I think in the back of my mind, or maybe more in the front of my mind, he would have loved, you know, every one of them. And I'm really glad I did it. Now, apropos Mo Berg, has a parallel reason why I made it. There's a very generous man named William Levine who loved my Hank Greenberg film, and we became friends. And one day, several years ago, he says to me, you know, Aviva, there's some other Jewish sports figures you should make a film about. And he said, you know, what about Barney Ross, the famous Jewish boxer? And I said, but I don't like boxing. I couldn't sustain making a film about that. He says, okay, don't worry. How about Sid Luckman, the famous Jewish football player? And I said, you know, Bill, and here I'm saying no to a fully funded film. Sorry, can't do football. But luckily, the third one was Mo Berg, and I just loved it. Because it was about another baseball player. He was so intriguing. And quite frankly, I love spy movies. And a World War II, you know, trying to stop Hitler or the Nazis from developing a nuclear power. I mean, actually, we wouldn't even be here talking if they had. So it was a no-brainer. So oftentimes people can, that are, you know, and as I think a lot from Bill's own background, that he loves sports so much, and it's such an anomaly, less so now, that there would be a Jewish hero in sports, that he was willing to make the film, and he's very happy with it, and so am I.
Excellent. There are several other questions embedded here of mine and from other people who've sent me questions. Starting with the making a movie about Mo Berg, there was a fiction movie about Mo Berg made that came out just the year before. And there's the Catcher Was a Spy, and that's based on a book by Nicholas Davidoff, I guess is how I would pronounce it, who you do interview in the film, in the Mo Berg film.
Absolutely.
So was this just a coincidence? Was there any sense of competition? Were you frustrated to find out this thing came out just before yours came out?
All of the above.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is, you know, for years, there were a lot of projects of people wanting to make a film. And if I had been there in person, this is how I would have introduced the film tonight. That I decided to go make this film. And I remembered that my cameraman for Hank Greenberg about 20 years ago had said to me, Jerry Feldman, you know, I was trying to make a film about Mo Berg and I never made it. So after Bill offered me the, you know, to exec produce, I contacted Jerry. It turns out that he and Neil Goldstein had both done all these interviews and the film never got made. And the interviews were put at Princeton, which we all know that's where Mo went to school, if you've seen the film. Luckily for me, he filmed all these fellow players and fellow OSS people. Mm-hmm. So there are 18 interviews in the film you saw tonight that I didn't film, but I, you know, digitized and used. And I am so grateful to them. You see, hopefully you saw the end credits that I gave him, give them both a lot of credit. So, you know, that made all the difference in the world. And also to do the film now, as opposed to years ago, is a lot more OSS stuff is declassified. But there's a word in Yiddish, bubbamaisins. There's a lot of old wives' tales about what Mo did. For instance, there's one story that Mo parachuted in Yugoslavia and helped Tito. Now, it is true that Mo was ahead of the Balkan desk, but he did not go into Yugoslavia. And so I even found footage at the National Archives that says Mo Berg with Tito. And I got so excited and I looked at it and sent it to his counselor in Irwin. The problem is it wasn't Mo. Also, there's, you know, the story and it has to do with what you do in feature films as opposed to docs. I try to be as truthful from every detail I could find, which includes there were no shootouts. And in the film, the dramatic film, there are. And there is one line that Nick Davidoff has in the book that Mo was bisexual, or one player thought he was. There is nothing I found. And then, you know, you see in the film that he was actually living with a woman and had a real relationship. And I think she was the love of his life. So and then also the shootouts in the film, it just didn't occur. Sorry. It's
whatever one says.
So,
thank you. No, and you're touching on a number of the things that I've been curious about, and other people have been curious about, having to do with sources and also fundraising. One student did want to talk a little bit more. Wanted to hear you talk a little bit more about how you generate funding, how you access funding, and what's your relationship like with your fundraiser.
It was only with this fifth film did Bill Levine say, "I'll fund it." Although I have to say, with Partisans of Vilna, we got a big grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hank Greenberg, I call my bat mitzvah film, because it took me 13 years to make. And you'll see, and you know, I think it's really worth it, but it's, there's a great line at the end of, well, I'll tell you the line and you tell me, for some reason I'm having a senior moment. The one with Marlon Brando where he goes, "Stella."
A Streetcar Named Desire.
What?
Streetcar Named Desire.
Right. And at the end, as she's going off to the loony bin, which I guess is not politically correct to call it, she says, "I depend on the kindness of strangers."
Right.
And that's a lot about what the fundraising is. You know, writing people who are somehow connected to the first, you know, either from that area, I know who would love the subject. It's still the kind of things I'm doing now. And just people who want to see the film made. And it really makes a big difference to have a film as opposed, I think, to a book, because it's something people can visualize. They can see the different witnesses. Now, you know, the big challenge, and maybe this will be a question you're going to ask, with Mo Berg, more than Hank Greenberg, is there less footage of Mo? One, and two is he didn't have a camera with him being a spy.
Right.
So the last third of the film is a lot of feature footage. But luckily, I think Hollywood oftentimes gets it, you know, does a great job. And there's nothing like film noir spy movies in my book.
Yeah, this certainly touches on two of my questions, one about, and also some others' questions, one about the fact that, I mean, with Hank Greenberg, you had this public life throughout his life, his time as a baseball player, and then a front office person, and gets interviewed for like 50 best baseball players of the century or whatever kind of thing. You know, Mo Berg lived this public life during his baseball years, but there's very little about him as a private person. You just mentioned the dramatic ones. I mean, is that, you said the other day, you feel like that's becoming more and more a part of your practice. What's the appeal for you of including feature films or footage of feature films?
Well, look, as it turns out, Molly, whatever she wrote and starred and produced in, which were all fabulous. I mean, I could have a 50-hour film of just all her films. What she wrote and the characters she developed and the themes, they're all in her films. Mm-hmm. Like you said, with Hank, there's so much footage of everything. But with Rosenwald, which is over 100 years ago, I had to use feature footage to show, you know, what a peddler was, to show what it meant to, well, there is footage of Black kids, but, you know, going to school, but a lot of it you have to develop. But certainly with Mo Berg, it's all dependent on the OSS training films and the great old feature footage. And there was actually one company and one film, which I can't remember the name, and for good reason, is they refused to let me use it without the name at the bottom. And I called my editor, I didn't sleep well that night, and I said, you know, I can't use it because I don't want to, I want people to suspend belief and think that, you know, certain characters, which I'm showing you, is really Mo. So we didn't use it. And as it is, there were two OSS people being interviewed and they insisted we used ESPN on it. But when we put it in black and white, you could hardly see it. So, and it was the real people. So that was okay.
Several people noticed that. I remember that Gary Cooper plays a baseball player in another movie. But I read that in Cloak and Dagger, he's actually playing a physicist. Yeah. The sequence where he's doing his spy work.
And then, you know, I sort of have bragging rights, you know, for each movie. Although I have to say in Rosenwald, I used a scene with Sidney Poitier, a little scene, because it was very crowded conditions for African-Americans in Chicago, from Raisin in the Sun, the movie. Mm-hmm. And it was locked. And any future filmmakers in your class or anyone listening, you got to really clear these rights before. And then I had written him and said, I hope we can use it. And his first answer to me was no. So I almost fainted, but you know, chutzpah, having gall is one of the ways you become a producer. But sadly, Julian Bond, the great civil rights leader who had inspired me to make Rosenwald, had just passed away. So I wrote a passionate letter and said, "Dear Mr. Poitier, you know, Julian inspired me to make this film. He's in the film. He, his father and uncle had gotten Rosenwald grants. I know he saw the film. He loved you in it. It would be a great disappointment." And sure enough, I actually had a wake, or like a shiva, at my house after Julian died. All of a sudden my phone rings and there's great accents on the phone. It's Sidney Poitier. And he says, okay. You know, and then of course in Rosenwald, I also had a little scene where I had Clint Eastwood speaking Yiddish in a scene about a peddler. Oh, that was the day I said, oh, I wish my father was alive. But in Hank Greenberg, there's a scene from Gentleman's Agreement to show the anti-Semitism at the time and how you can't check into a hotel. And it was the one movie that really was depicting anti-Semitism then. But the reason I really wanted to use it is Hank later on, as an owner, they went to a owner's meeting in Arizona. In fact, he could not check into a hotel. But that's the back story. It's just like using Raisin in the Sun, because Lorraine Hansberry, who died way too young, her father had done desegregation cases in Chicago. And so I felt there was a connection there. I mean, of course, I wanted it to begin with, but.
So the question of anti-Semitism is certainly something that has come up a lot in the classes I teach on film, not surprisingly. And it was a question several students asked. And particularly given the cultural milieu that Mo Berg was in, that he's, you know, he's born in New York City, he grows up in Newark, but then he goes to Princeton, not particularly known as being a place at the time that was friendly towards Jews. Plays Major League Baseball, not exactly a hotbed. I mean, there were plenty of Jewish players, but there was plenty of anti-Semitism as well. People were interested to hear a little bit more about how the experience of being Jewish shaped Mo's experience of those institutions and the other institutions he operated in.
Except for the experience at Princeton, when they have these dinner clubs that Jews couldn't belong, but because he was on the baseball team, he could belong, but couldn't bring others, so he didn't want to belong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that line, I don't want to bring a club that doesn't want me, or the Groucho line.
Yeah.
So I did not find any other existence. It wasn't in David Auth's book or anywhere. And I think part of the reason so much was directed against Hank is he was a great slugger. Mm-hmm. And he was out of Detroit, so half the games were there. And Mo just did not get that. However, every day he was in the OSS, especially going around Europe and Nazi Europe, as a Jew, as an American, and they would have found he was a baseball player, he risked, you know, his life. So I would say that that was when he was facing it the most. Mm-hmm.
You talked a little bit earlier about people you interview, and we had several questions about that as well. And okay. One of the things, having seen a few more of your movies than my students or than perhaps some other audience members,
my Walter Matthau story?
I definitely want to hear the Walter Matthau story, but also I counted two senators and one Supreme Court justice. And by the way, when I've shown that clip of Ruth Bader Ginsburg to my class, or when my daughters saw it, that's always the moment that people go like this. They go, So, but how do you, you know, very busy people.
So I live in Washington, D.C. Uh-huh. Remember I've used the word chutzpah, having a lot of gall. It basically is not being shy. With 11 brothers, it's different. I always knew that I wanted not only to make a film about Hank Elliott, but about how people adored him and how he was a symbol of, you know, male strength, but even more than that, you know, the women adored him too. And I don't know if you've ever seen Diner. I think Diner is brilliant. But a lot of it is also about, you know, how people have this thing about, you know, being fans, sports fans, It right. goes way over the top. I wanted to be way over the top, which my three guys are. So, and I knew already the Levin brothers, both Carl and Sander. They were cousins of good friends of my parents. And the minute I said I was going to do a Hank Greenberg film, I mean, to see these incredible, as a matter of fact, I once wanted to make a film about the brothers Levin, but it never worked out. In any event,
but we should just remind people, Carl Levin was a senator from Michigan and Sander was a congressional
congressman also from Michigan. And now Sander's son, Andy, is a congressman from Michigan. So to me, to see their faces, you know, these two top officials, you know, to talk about those days, it's like back then. So that was easy. So I was making Molly Goldberg and I was at the French embassy and there was RBG before we were calling her RBG. And I went up and I said, Justice Ginsburg, my name is Aviva Kempner. And I'm making this film on Gertrude Berg. And she said, oh my gosh, she was my heroine growing up, you know, next to Nancy Drew. So it was great. I was able to interview her and we developed a whole relationship. Actually, we did a great introduction of the film at the Jewish Film Festival in Washington. And I'll never forget, because I mentioned something about, you know, I wouldn't have made this film if I had passed the bar. I tried twice. So she says, well, I tried four times to get my driver's license and you should have kept on trying. But it was true. If I had passed, I would have gone and become an immigration lawyer and not a human rights lawyer and never have interviewed her. But what with the movie you just saw, I knew I didn't have an ending for Mo Berg. And it turns out I'm social friends with Susan Blumenthal, who's married to Ed Markey. And I contacted her and I said, hey, you know, I know Ed was a big Boston Red Sox fan. And sure enough, he said, no, I'd love to talk about Mo Berg. The only issue is when I was going to film and finally, you know, do the final scenes. He was my last interview. He had just introduced with AOC the Green New, whatever they call it, the Green New, New Green Bill. Yeah.
Right.
So I had to wait and wait for that. But right where I'm sitting, he sat right in front of where I am and he did a beautiful job. And I think really, you know, gave a very impassionate thing. He was a real hero for us. Because really, so many of these OSS people, and one thing I want to say now is I think what's really important about the OSS is how many children of immigrants made a difference because of the language skills. You saw how Mo's languages helped him get in and out. And the Italians he, you know, worked with, we have Paul Ferry in the film talking about his father. Well, his father, of course, was right there. But it was the other two people, the OSS, who got him over there. And, you know, you can just imagine today who we have in Iran helping us or North Korea. And, you know, language skills. I mean, if anything, it's ironic that I say it because I came to this country having spoken German and I didn't keep it up. But each one of my parents knew six or seven languages. So you're going to be a spy, you all, that going to school.
This is a great, actually, I have many other questions on other threads, but I want to go to a question that actually came from a family member. And I, you know, I'm married to someone who works in a number of foreign languages and is a big advocate of language learning. And the question, which I don't know if it's hers or another family member watching downstairs, but what is your favorite movie?
Favorite movie? Yeah. By the way, I do swear fluently. I do swear fluently in Yiddish.
Excellent.
Well, it's interesting because I think it's apropos what we were talking about just before. I think Casablanca may be my favorite all-time movie. Mm-hmm. Again, World War II romance. And, you know, I was just going through the best romantic movies. So many of them, they don't end up in the end. And this is apropos the new movie I'm working on, who's been hacked. Again, Bill Levine said to me, you know, there's this one film project I really want you to do. And this is a man who is a great writer, newspaper man and writer in Chicago, then went and wrote some of the greatest screenplays, including Notorious, did work on Gone with the Wind, did William Wyler's films, but he also wrote Marilyn Monroe's autobiography, which is, I got to find someone to talk about that. But more importantly, he just realized what was happening to European Jewry, and he worked very hard writing pageants, doing everything he could, big want ads, trying to say, hey, we got to save European Jewry. Unfortunately, most people, especially in the State Department, did not listen to him, and actually cost his career with England because he was impassioned about trying to help people get to Palestine. So I think someone who's in my business who had a real sense of morality during World War II is very appealing to me.
Well, that is definitely.
So he had, and I'm going to use a scene from Casablanca. So it goes.
We should all use scenes from Casablanca whenever we can.
Yeah.
However,
I can talk you two and three and four. You know, I think I've revised myself on Gone with the Wind because there is real problems in terms of the African-American characters. But I think three or four. I have to think some more what the other ones are.
Other in the Ben Hecht movie.
I'm sorry?
To go into the Ben Hecht movie.
Oh, no. I'm just talking about my favorite.
Oh, favorite movies. Okay, so Gone with the Wind, you're kind of moving that one down the list. Casablanca is the permanent number one.
Right.
Okay, we can come back to this at the end if you think of any others. So there were a number of questions. We talked a certain amount about the OSS in class today, and there were a number of questions about that. And one of the things we talked about was the where they did their recruiting, that the intelligence services in the US and the intelligence services in the UK were really known for going to these prestigious universities to do their recruiting. You know, there's certainly, we all have these associations of the CIA with Yale and Skull and Bones and so forth. And so there was some question about how much do we know about where was OSS recruiting right at the beginning. You know, Mo Berg on the one hand fits a certain template as a Princeton grad, on the other hand, as a Jew and a baseball player, doesn't seem to fit the typical profile. So
right. First of all, did you survey people? I need to ask people, did anyone know about the OSS before they saw the film? I'm always curious about that.
I did not survey my students about this.
Okay. I think a lot of it had to do with Wild Bill Donovan.
Mm-hmm.
He favored athletes because think about it, you could get away.
Mm-hmm.
He was not, the irony is because later on we became so anti-communist, but he was fine about taking people who were in the CP Communist Party. He was fine about taking working class people because, you know, people who could do people who were safe thieves, you know. I mean, it was like anything to defeat the Nazis. So it is true that a lot of, especially the leadership, was Ivy League. But actually, it turns out that there was a whole array of people. And I think language skills clearly made a difference.
Thank you. I was thinking about, this is totally unrelated to this, but Michael Chabon's book, Moonglow.
I haven't read.
Yeah, so Wild Bill Donovan plays a key role there as well.
Hmm.
There were also, we had lots of different kinds of questions. We've already talked a bit about the archival footage you use, the interviews and those, you know, that incredible, I mean, the fact that you were able to access all these interviews of Mo's teammates and family members, you know, footage from a number of years ago. But I've certainly been aware watching a number of your movies, how important the archives are to you, both for visual stuff, for stills, for newspaper clippings, for a whole range of things. Could you talk a bit about how you use archives, what kind of research you do, what do you farm out? You know, just talk about that process if you would.
Well, let me just say one thing that I think my favorite footage is the Lefty Gomez family, because mm-hmm. he had a camera on in that ship, you know, going to Japan in the 30s. I mean, to have those kind of, you know, Babe Ruth and the others and Mo just sitting around the ship playing baseball, nothing's like that. Mm-hmm. And the family couldn't have been sweeter about letting, you know, me have it. anything goes. And I always hire, you know, at a good expense, really trained archivists, both to stills and footage and feature footage. As a matter of fact, every time I'm making a film, and especially right now with Ben Heck, because he made so many films, I'm watching feature footage all the time. Mm-hmm. So you, and then you just keep on asking anyone, do you have any footage? Do you know anyone else that has footage? Do you have any stills? Because you can do a lot with motion, you know. And sometimes when you move on a still, it's almost like having it there. But I have to say, it also has to do with imagination. For Rosenwald, you know, there's a discussion early in the film how his Rosenwald's parents were married and the father had been a peddler. So we use a scene from Gene Wilder, this rabbi movie. And then there's a scene of him getting married. And I'll never forget an agent, a critic comes out of the movie. Well, he's a writer, he's not a critic. And he says to me, Aviva, how did you get that footage? Rosenwald's, you know, so it would have been his, Rosenwald's parents, you know, getting married. And I just laughed because he believed it.
Right. You know? The Frisco Kid.
Frisco Kid. I'm not doing real well on memories today, but.
It's all right. That's why I'm here. One of my students was interested, again, we've been talking a lot about Jewish identity, about, you know, religious identity versus cultural identity, how these things intersect and overlap. And there was some talk early in the movie about the fact that, I guess it was Mo's father was the immigrant, and he left in part to escape religious Judaism. That he
identified- Orthodox Judaism, right.
Right. So he identified as a cultural Jew, but he found Orthodox Judaism as it was practiced in the shtetl was too restrictive. So that's some of what motivated him to come to America. With Mo and his siblings, like where did they fall along this continuum?
I don't have much evidence of him going to synagogue. It's not like the great story of Hank going, you know, for services, but he did know some Hebrew and he knew Yiddish. And I am sure for both he and his brother, a lot of it had to do with because they were Jewish and what was happening with the Nazis. Don't forget, and I made a clear, you know, we made it very clear in the film, Mo had been traveling in Europe and in 1933 saw, you know, Hitler taking power. He knew, or he would talk about Mussolini, you know, in the dugout, you know, so he clearly knew what was happening. Uh-huh. So in terms of that, the thing that gets me about the father, he never went to one baseball game of his son. That wasn't true of the Greenberg's kids. And, you know, it is this class, you know, for each one of my films, we have Rosenwald who, you know, helped build with African-American communities, 5,000 schools, but left school at the age 16. We have Gertrude Berg who developed this persona of this loving, caring mother, but whose own mother was mentally ill and institutionalized. And we have, you know, Mo Berg, who had a father who would never go to any of his games. So it's sort of a classic for each one of them. And as a matter of fact, Ben Hecht, who, you know, wrote some of the best columns, the most incredible screenplays, went to college. I shouldn't probably say this to you, but for 4 days and left for Wisconsin. He never went to college. So, but he was very learned. I mean, he read a lot of the classics. His parents had given it to him for his bar mitzvah. But it is interesting that, you know, college education doesn't guarantee success in life.
Right. So, but that's not the main message we're setting to our students. That's okay.
Right. Forget I said it, kids.
Yes. So I wanted to ask, we're talking about the service that Mo Berg, you know, Mo Berg's service through the OSS. Hank Greenberg was the first Major League Baseball player to go into the Army, was in there for a little while, mustered out on December 5th, 1941, and then was right back in and spent more time in the service than any other baseball player. Really,
four and a half years.
Right. So those were incredibly prime years. He would have been a 500 home run hitter and all of that. So I guess my question is, and again, this is something you really deal with in both movies, but the sense that their commitment to I mean, they identified as Americans, but they also identified as fighting the Nazis. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about the ways that this was important to them and the evidence that it's important to them.
Well, Hank's son has this great line in the film, you know, because in 38, he's almost beating Babe Ruth. He's doing well, you know, still keeps on hitting. And he said it was like almost every home run was against Hitler. And that's how people perceived it. So I don't know if, I can't remember if Moe's autobiography edited by Ira Burkow, he actually says it, but that's how, you know, he would talk to his son for years. You know, they had a really strong relationship. For Moe, I think there was just no doubt. I mean, if he had stayed as a, what do you call it? He was a coach for the Red Sox. He probably would have gone on to be a manager, but he just knew he had to go serve. His father died before he knew he went to serve, but I think his father had said some things to him. And then his brother, I mean, can you imagine going off and, you know, trying after, and the two brothers didn't know. One was trying to spy on the Nazis to see about the nuclear power, and the other one was trying to see the after effects. So it's pretty incredible what which both members of the family gave.
That is really remarkable. One of my students asked about some of the things you didn't include in the Moe Burke movie. Mm-hmm. Were there things that you, there were a number of questions about the choices you make as a filmmaker, and we'll, you know, get into a few of the other ones, but let's start with that. What were some of the things that you would like to have talked about, or if there's footage you wish you could have used, or the parts of his life that you didn't address?
Okay, so there's one great story, and it'll be on, if we have bonus features or a DVD, and this is a post story, which of course is the sad part. I mean, Mo just never, I think he was traumatized from, you know, all those years of secret, scary spy life, that people, I think he finally got sick and tired of telling everyone, shh, I can't say what didn't happen or what happened. So he finally was going to take a meeting to write his autobiography and sat down. I don't know if the guy was a book agent, if the guy was represented a book company, and he's going to lunch, and all of a sudden the guy says to him, well, tell me what it means to be part of the Three Stooges, because he mistakenly thought he was having lunch with Mo of the Three Stooges.
Oh my God.
So for your young students who don't know who the Three Stooges were, they're sort of like the Marx Brothers. They were slapstick, very, and Jewish, very funny actors. So he got up and left, and we never had the autobiography. So, you know, he died with the secrets. It was between that and the Einstein story at the end of the movie, and I just decided to go with the Einstein story.
Right.
I also was still trying to figure out if, in fact, he really was buried in Israel, but I couldn't get anyone to prove it. And, you know, I think that is the most apropos thing about Mo, that we really don't know if his body was taken over there. I mean, you know, it's a mystery. And I think it's totally appropriate.
That fact is still unknown, that mystery is unknown.
And I really had some good people look into it, but we could never verify.
And so this brings me to another question that I had, which is about, I mean, you mentioned he seemed like clearly being groomed to be a coach or manager or to do something in baseball. But there's, you know, the movie ends, you know, and again, there's mystery about what he does during the war, but there's really nothing about, there's just some comments about how he spent his life, but there's nothing about it in the movie. Was there not a story there? Was he just sort of...
He just went to a lot of baseball games. It's very sad, lived off a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know if you, there was a movie where Meryl Streep was in, where she plays someone in the resistance, and the film is about after the war.
Mm-hmm. Plenty.
Plenty. Boy, you're a really good source for me. And she just couldn't have a life afterwards. And right. I always thought that's what I thought happened to Mo. And also he wanted to be in the CIA and they didn't take him. And also because he had some problems with some people in the OSS. So I think he should have been in the in the CIA afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That that would have been a career.
That, you know, that the Dulles, who had been the head of Switzerland office, he had disputes with him. So it's just very sad.
Okay. Yeah, no, this is actually one of the things I read in some of the reviews about the Davidoff book, is that the last, you know, that last period of his life is just kind of sad. I'm trying to think where we've covered so much of what we came in wanting.
Well, I didn't tell you my Walter Matthau
story. Oh yes, we need to hear the Walter Matthau story for sure.
So I'm filming him in LA because he's a big Hank Greenberg fan, and I knew he used to see him. So he didn't want to be filmed at his house. And it turns out that my cousin-in-law, who befriended me, was just wonderful. He and his wife was Arthur Hiller, who was a great director in his own right. He had done Love Story, among other stories. So we filmed him at Arthur's house, and he comes in and he brings Lenny, his agent. So Lenny's sitting there, and you know, you need to have the person look at you. You're the side of the camera. So you know, that's how you want the interview to go. But he kept on looking at Lenny. So after the first question, I said, you know, Mr. Matthau, it would be really great if you don't mind, would you look at me? So without missing a beat, he says, your husband has to look at you. I don't have to look at you. Just cracked me up. And then I knew he knew Yiddish. So I thought, oh, I said, you know, Mr. Matthau, it'd be great if you used some Yiddish words. Also, always thinking of my father. So then the next question he answered completely in Yiddish. So, but then he went back to English. So be careful. Don't mess with famous comedians or, you know, whatever. So.
Well, he has that great story about joining the Beverly Hills Tennis Club just because.
Could have a lot of lunch with Hank Greenberg.
Yeah. If he wasn't actually interested in playing tennis. I wanted to ask about the Japanese footage, the footage that Moberg shoots when he's standing on the roof of the hospital in Tokyo. It looks like a few minutes of silent home movies that later become part of the Doolittle raid. Where were you able to access that? Is that held in an archive?
Well, it turns out that the footage, if I remember correctly, the family had sent it to his brother had sent it to people in Japan, and then we got it back, and then we had to figure out about rights, but that's how we got it. And you know, for a while we had Doolittle as a pitcher on the Nationals. Unfortunately, he's no longer here, but he was a distant relative, and I thought, oh, maybe I can get an interview, but I never did. But and also the Gomez footage was also sent to the War Department. And we don't know if they really used it. I think with Mo they did because of the landscape he had and everything. So it was able to be used for our raid back here. I mean, so, back on Japan.
So that is still not like absolutely confirmed, but that's just something that it seems right. Likely. Yeah. That was another part of that question for me. Some people asked about the Goodwill tour just like was so amazing, such amazing footage in the movie. And some people also asked about having Berg and Babe Ruth having sort of had this direct contact with Japanese fans and Japanese players, that they were being used for sort of propaganda purposes. How did that go?
The crowds, they just went crazy over him. Mm-hmm. So you saw the reactions, and then of course the footage, you know, that was there. What I thought the most fascinating story to me was hearing from his daughter over the phone, because she was too old for to be filmed, and that's what the family arranged for, that as soon as her father heard about Pearl Harbor, he started throwing out in the window. And actually, it was shot on Riverside Drive right outside that apartment building. So it only shows you. And you know, there's another story about Babe Ruth that wasn't going to fit in my film, where he actually befriended some Jewish kids who have been refugees. So he was quite clear on where he stood.
Hmm. Wow, very cool.
Love, of course, is to have Babe Ruth's daughter saying, you know, he would flirt with me. I did dance with him. I mean, you know, everyone talked about how he loved being out with women and dancing. So That's why I never brought up the one line from, from David Ost's book that the dramatic movie took another way. I mean, it was just all made up.
Yeah, I mean, one of my students, we talked about that in class. They had, I'm not sure if they'd seen the movie or they had like looked at Wikipedia or whatever, these claims. And so this was just something you never saw any evidence of.
Or I would have put it in, you know. Right. But...
And
his relationship with Estelle was so profound. So, you know, and I had the son talking about it. So
another question I have for you, this is again from one of my...
And those pictures with them on the beach, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
You know, again, a picture can tell a thousand, whatever the line is. Is there a line with that?
Yeah, 1,000 words.
Right. Almost half.
So, 95% of it. Is there, one of my students wanted to know, of the movies you've made, is there one that you are... Like you like the story the most, or you're like most happy about the content?
No, it's like having five kids or five and a half kids, because I have a short too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I never play favorites.
We have a question. Actually, I was wondering about this. I'm glad someone in our audience asked. Why didn't Mo marry Estelle?
Well, I think what happened is he was going off. He knew his missions were very dangerous. So I always see that, you know, although he did wind up having something in London, I know I read about it, and I met someone who knew the woman who it was. But I think he just didn't want to leave her a possible widow, or maybe didn't want to have that commitment. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's this other thing I have to say. My grandmother on my father's side was Estelle. And when I look at Mo Berg, I see my grandfather, who I never met, he died long before I was born, but my grandfather looks a lot like Mo Berg.
Really?
Yeah, I'll send
very
you.
Very good looking man, yeah.
My grandfather was a very good looking man, also true. So we're sort of getting towards the end. We have a couple of those sort of closing-ish questions. You've already talked a little bit about projects you're working on. Do you want to say more about the Ben Hecht movie and what else you're working on right now?
Okay. You know, I'm not quite sure how I got in this position. A sports columnist who is also an ESPN commentator, Kevin Blackstone, brought me a project about Native American mascoting, sort of the insidious use of horrible names and symbols, what we just had in Washington before it became the Washington football team. We still have Atlanta with the tomahawk chop. We still have the Chicago Blackhawks, which is, Doug said it was his team. So I'm co-directing with a young Cheyenne director who we've already, it turns out before I went to law school, I was working with Native Americans in Vista. So something long, and Kevin didn't even know that when he came to me. So we're doing something, it turns out to be such a hot topic because every week there's more headlines about it. And a lot of it has been prompted by the Black Lives Movement. So we're very excited about that. And we have an executive producer of a tribe out in California. And, you know, there's some young Native American athletes that are in the film. And we hope some directors and actors, but really it's our profession, Hollywood, who has perpetuated the worst stereotypes about Native Americans, which then led to what we are arguing is these names. Then the next film is Ben Hecht, which, you know, the biggest challenge is it's delayed a year because how do you film in person? But with imagining the Indian, we are doing it by Zoom, you know, hiring, like we just had a cameraman in Tulsa, in Chicago, we'll have in Kansas City, the head of NAACP in Mississippi. And you do the pre-interviews and you trust the cameraman, and it's really worked out well. And the third one is a short. And this is because I heard this discussion once, you know, when they built the Congress, and this has to go more to my architecture master's and urban planning degree, they built it never thinking a woman would be in Congress, a House or the Senate side. So they never built bathrooms near the, you know, where people talk. And it really hit me last night when you saw both Pelosi and Harris, you know, behind the president. So it's called Pissed Off, and it's about potty parity in Congress and how the women had a fight to be able to have it. And actually, the biggest issue is, okay, so now they have bathrooms off the House and the Senate side, but they don't have enough stalls. So it's sort of using a little humor to deal with issues of exclusionary architecture.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That sounds great.
And part of the reason I'm not all here today is trying to do a lot of fundraising today, you know, on it. So you sort of have to craft the letters and also to look up my old Ben Heck notes that I did a year and a half ago and try to remember why I had that note, because now I have to zoom in by city where I'm going to have these interviews. But it's a little bit of a juggling act, but hopefully this time next year, at least I'll have two of the films done.
Great. And I guess this may be our last or almost last question. One of the students looked up a little bit about you and some of the things you mentioned about your own qualifications, that you started out in law school and then changed careers, and said, hey, that's just like Mo Berg. There, like, to what extent do you identify with your own subject matter? What are your own subjects?
Well, I have no athletic abilities, but, you know, I think this is a good way to segue to the one thing I did want to say. You know, they're very concerned what's happening in the world. And for me, I live in DC and we don't have voting rights or statehood. Mm-hmm. And that's why I dedicate all my films. Actually, it was so funny because I did a Mo Berg discussion last night. And at the end, I saw my old end credits and it said, change the name of the Washington football team. And I thought, yes. Two years ago, who knew? Because Dan Schneider said never.
Right.
For me, I always dedicate, usually beforehand, all my talks to statehood for DC. Well, I'm calling it now 51 and 21. You know, they just passed a bill in the House, and the big thing is the Senate. Mm-hmm. So I think that all my characters really care, are passionate about what they're doing, you know, to improve the world or improve conditions. I think that's what I identify with also.
Great. I was thinking of asking another question, but that's really the perfect ending. So I think
Now you're going to make me wonder what it is.
Okay, fine. I'll ask the last question, even though that was a great ending. It's like almost as good as Ed Markey's line in the other movie. And you already talked a little bit about this, but how has the pandemic changed your work, both How has all the shut-in and lockdown and the pandemic changed?
It's very hard to film. I mean, you know, so much of it has been is research, but now we're getting going on that. So it's great. But most important, you know, everyone should get shots and wear masks and be careful.
And we do have, this was something in the Q&A, another thing, which was just that this was great. This was a friend of mine from a friend from our synagogue, actually.
Oh, great.
There. So, Aviva, thank you so much. We normally would like the best, there'd be this great thing where we get to mill around or maybe have dinner or something, but
we'll have to do that
some other time. Thank you so much for coming. It's been wonderful having you here. Thank you to everyone who came out there in webinar land. And as someone said once, there's not a really good way to end a webinar except to just say it's over.
Good night.
So, good night. Thank you, everybody.
Stay safe. Bye-bye. Yeah.